KALW.
From KALW News in San Francisco, this is Cross Currents. Context, culture, and connection from around the Bay Area.
San Mateo.
San Francisco, Mission Dolores Park.
Financial District near the Tenderloin.
San Bruno.
North Sunnyvale.
Downtown Palo Alto, my beloved.
Redwood City.
Coming up, the historical significance behind a special creek in East Oakland.
People would have sailed down on tule boats to the bayshore, and that's how a lot of our villages were connected, through creeks and people going down to those other villages along those waterways.
Then we'll drop into the Russian River to count salmon and see how healthy the population is.
We snorkel in as little as like a couple inches of water sometimes. Like we really can drag ourselves through it to get numbers and get eyes on the fish.
What's in the water? Stay tuned. Cross Currents is coming up. Did you know when you pass through East Oakland and head towards downtown, you cross over Saucel Creek? Whether you're riding down the highway or city streets, you go right over it. But chances are you haven't seen it. That's because it's been largely fenced off, paved over, or piped underground below the 580 freeway. But if you head up above MacArthur Boulevard starting at Diamond Park, you can follow Saucel Creek undisturbed all the way up to Highway 13. KALW listener Jason Wallach asked our Hay Area East Oakland project about the creek. Jason wanted to know, the hiking trail that runs along Saucel Creek, did it exist before the Europeans came to California? We asked Bill Joyce, a reporter with our partner Oakland Voices, to dig into some Oakland history for the answer.
I'm a 20-year resident of the Laurel District and one of the folks who drives Stan Dodson crazy.
My name is Stan Dodson, and I'm the founder and executive director of Oakland Trails.
Dodson wants to get Oakland residents, like me, off their butts and onto the 500 miles of trails that wind through the East Bay Hills.
Our organization, it's an all-volunteer nonprofit that our mission is to promote, maintain, and enhance Oakland's wildland parks and trails.
Lightly bearded, wearing a beanie, cargo shorts, and a day pack, Dodson's well-worn boots mark a hiker who really does tread these trails daily. He's hiked or biked every single day, rain or shine, for the past 10 years. Even though his morning began at 3 a.m., as manager of a nearby bakery, he's still full of life this afternoon. We meet up at the El Centro Avenue trailhead.
Diamond Park is 14 acres of just kind of regular city park. It's got picnic areas and playgrounds and a rec center and a swimming pool and tennis courts, all those things. But as soon as you cross the street and step foot here in Diamond Canyon, it's just pure open space.
Dodson has led hikes for school kids, seniors, and anyone else who's interested. He works with hikers, bikers, community groups, and city officials to improve the Saucel Creek watershed and encourage its use. Dodson keeps a brisk pace, pointing out examples of Oakland Trail's work, like the blue-tiled mosaic markers set in the ground at the canyon's trailheads and intersections.
All the mosaics are basically, they got a big arrow on them and a nameplate, so this particular one says Diamond Canyon Trail, and it's pointing straight up the trail here into the woods.
He points to a bed of rock recently laid to beat back erosion, next to a bank of native plant seedlings. We walk over a simple wooden footbridge he helped build to span a small seasonal stream. We have the trail largely to ourselves as we fade further and further away from the sounds of the city.
We're going to have to do a little bit of rock hopping. You guys okay with that?
On the other side of Saucel Creek, Old Canyon Trail once brought San Francisco weekenders by horse and buggy into the hills to hunt and fish in the late 1800s. Now houses in the Oakmore neighborhood peek over treetops and the Lamert Bridge. Below is a deep ravine carved out by the twists and turns of Saucel Creek over the centuries. The forest is a mix of native oak, bay, and buckeye trees, alongside non-native Monterey, cypress, and eucalyptus. As we get closer to Highway 13...
here's kind of our first glimpse of redwoods. Now, Oakland basically has an ancient redwood forest.
The ancestors of these redwoods fueled Gold Rush era construction, much of which built the sleepy settlement of Yerba Buena into boomtown San Francisco.
literally they cut down all the redwoods in the Oakland Hills, except for Old Survivor, which still stands in Leona Heights Park.
Ships in San Francisco Bay set their bearings by the giant redwoods that once covered the Oakland Hills. We pass under Highway 13 and walk a short distance to where the trails fan out through the Saucel Creek watershed, up the Oakland Hills to its headwaters and beyond.
This is a really popular trailhead to Joaquin Miller Park. We're kind of at the lowest part of Joaquin Miller at the Palos Colorados Trail.
The Palos Colorados marks the end of my hike with Stan Dodson. It's also a juncture for this story, because it is near here where some of the East Bay's first people made their homes for centuries, according to an Ohlone tribal member who introduces himself in Chochenyo, the ancient language of his ancestors.
Jorge tu himakam kanakra kats Vince Medina. So hello to you all. My name is Vincent Medina, and I'm a member and a councilman for the Muekma Ohlone tribe of the San Francisco Bay Area.
Medina, along with many descendants of Chochenyo-speaking Ohlone in the East and South Bay, reestablished themselves as the Muekma Ohlone tribe about 30 years ago.
The Spanish recorded when they forced our people into the missions that those old villages were in the Palos Colorados, the redwoods of the Oakland Hills. And some of those redwoods were some of the largest in the entire world before they were cut down. And those redwoods aren't too far from Saucel Creek, and that's where many of our villages were in those old days.
Medina describes the pre-colonized East Bay as a series of independent sovereign nations which settled seasonally along the creeks that flowed into the bay.
The area of Saucel Creek is most likely an area, a tribe called Huchun, spelled X-U-C, but the C has a little wedge over it, which is a ch sound, Y-U-N. And that's the way that we spell it in our language.
The Huchun Ohlone stretched along the East Bay Hills to the bayshore, from around El Cerrito to near Saucel Creek.
It's likely that Saucel Creek could be right there in the Huchun area. It's also likely it could be in the Halkeen area because it's kind of in a transitional space. But either way, the villages are Chochenyo-speaking villages.
Medina walks me back along Saucel Creek as it might have looked 250 years ago.
I'm sure people saw that creek as being alive, you know, because creeks are living entities. They move around. They're not stagnant, you know. They have life.
In the oak forest below,
I'm going to go up there during gathering times to get those seed plants, chia, red maize seeds, tarweed. You're going to go and you're going to gather acorns up there, you know, hunt venison, be able to have those controlled burns so that you're being able to manage the environment in a way that's respectful to the environment.
Villages are settled but move fluidly with the seasons. Upstream, people fish for salmon and steelhead. The waters flow by groves of willow, saucel in Spanish, and meander through marshes filled with tules, waterfowl, and sea lions.
People would have sailed down on tule boats to the bayshore, and that's how a lot of our villages were connected, through creeks and people on our tule boats going down to those other villages along those waterways or into the bayshore.
This time of abundance ended shortly after the Spanish built Mission San Jose near Fremont in 1797.
And around 1810, they kept track of everything.
Dennis Evanosky leads local history tours and has written several books about East Bay history.
And they wrote down in their paperwork that the Native Americans, the heathen they called them, the heathen were gone. And the three things happened to the heathen. They were either pulled in by the Spanish and Christianized, or they died of disease, or they fled.
Yeah, that's a very dangerous myth that existed, that still continues to exist, that's very harmful and has real-life repercussions when that's told.
Although many were killed or converted, the East Bay Ohlone survived the violent waves of European settlers for over a century. By the 1860s, the remaining Ohlone had secured a land base and by 1913 achieved tribal recognition for their rancheria near Sunol.
You know, close to Saucel Creek is also where my grandparents were married, over on MacArthur, where they had their first house. And not too far from where my grandpa was born, over at Highland Hospital. There's all these overlapping connections that are, you know, rooted in ancient, but also are modern as well, contemporary also. And it's because no generation of our folks have ever left this space. You know, everybody, and I mean everybody in my family has been here in the East Bay since those ancient times to today. You know, there's been no break.
Back in the 1920s, an influential professor named Alfred Kroeber made a determination that greatly impacted the Ohlone people.
He's this anthropologist at UC Berkeley. He wrote down that in the Handbook of California Indians, that the Ohlone people, he called us Costanoans during that time, for all practical purposes are extinct.
Within 2 years of Kroeber's declaration, the Ohlone had lost tribal recognition from the federal government. As a result, they not only lost their land, but the right to the remains of their ancestors. Bones of Ohlone people are among the thousands currently in storage at UC Berkeley. Almost a century later, Medina hasn't forgotten about those bones. He set up shop right across the street from the university and is rebuilding culture and traditions at Cafe Ohlone.
This is a nettle tea with bergamot and agave.
Tonight, I get to sample a cup of Ohlone tea and a taste of chia pudding with berries. The cafe works with elders to revive ancient recipes. They've also scoured thousands of pages, transcripts of archival recordings of their ancestors made on wax cylinders in the 1930s.
You know, they literally give us recipes for how to make these foods, and then they give us the language for the food, how to pronounce the words, how to revive our languages, you know, how to be able to have all these things back in the world a second time. And what we're doing right now is we see ourselves as doing this work, but doing what our people have always done.
The cafe is first a place for Ohlone to gather, a place to retrieve language, stories, songs, dances, and foods. But it's also for the rest of us.
We want to be able to tell our story, you know, and also when people can eat our food and sit down and see our culture, they see how much that we have, and it helps them understand, you know, this what the true identity of this space really is.
Gathering at the Cafe Ohlone makes us present to the issues alive for the Muwekma Ohlone today.
We hope that these messages then leave the table and go into the streets around us, you know, where people stand up for our community, stand up against those misconceptions when they hear them, and, you know, work for a better future that includes Ohlone people, you know, central here in our home.
Under the redwoods again, back on the Diamond Canyon Trail, this time by myself, I notice colorful flags where native plants are taking root near Sossel Creek. I think of the work of Oakland Trails and like-minded, largely volunteer efforts to keep these sanctuaries from the city alive for everyone to enjoy. Returning to Jason Wallach's question, historian Evanosky, lacking hard evidence, is hesitant to conclude that there were settlements right along Sossel Creek, but admits...
The answer is probably, it makes sense, that they were living or established themselves in places they considered important. You got to find out from the current Native Americans, what does their tradition say?
Ohlone tradition says that these trails existed from the time the first people lived and moved along Sossel Creek, a time when people belonged to the land rather than owning it, when Sossel Creek itself was a living, breathing being. For the Muwekma Ohlone, it will always be home.
Our people still live right here where we have always lived, and we've never given up our obligations to this land. You know, we love this place more than words can ever describe.
In Oakland, I'm Bill Joyce for Cross Currents.
That story was a collaboration between Oakland Voices and KELW as part of our project Hey Area and Sights and Sounds of East Oakland.
Thank you.
You're listening to Cross Currents from KALW News. I'm Hannah Baba. Well, it's that time again. Every summer around this time, fish biologists across California suction snorkel masks onto their faces for an important task. With scuba diving flashlights in hand, they crawl, swim, and slither up the tributaries of rivers, the Trinity, the Salmon, the Klamath, the Sacramento, and the Russian, literally counting the number and species of salmon they see to measure the health of the population. This way of monitoring the salmon and steelhead populations is effective, and it's low-tech, and it hasn't changed much over the years, but the salmon population in California has changed. Last year, KLW's Angela Johnston joined a snorkel survey at a small tributary of the Russian River, where the endangered species is struggling to make a comeback.
I'm on Willow Creek up near where the Russian River meets the Pacific Ocean. But no matter where you are in California, these snorkel surveys start in a pretty similar fashion. And it's unlike anything I've ever seen before. Three fish biologists from the group California Sea Grant climb into big, black, balloon-like suits and hop over fences or scurry down steep riverbanks, whacking away brush to get to the riverbed. They spit in their goggles to stop them from fogging up, check to make sure their field computers and flashlights are working, and prepare themselves for a face full of cold water. Here's Elizabeth Ruiz.
The first pool of the morning is always like a nice wake-up.
Then they do what's called the steelhead shuffle.
Okay, here I go.
Mariska Obazinski is the program leader and tells me this is one of her favorite spots to survey.
We're kind of looking upstream into this clear, cold water. There's, you know, a lot of gravel and just huge redwoods all around us. It's really quiet and peaceful, and it's just, you just know, like, when you see this is like, if I were a juvenile coho salmon or steelhead, this is where I would want to live, because it's so gorgeous.
Me too. Even if I wasn't a fish, I probably want to live here.
Not being a fish.
Coho salmon spend their entire first year of life in freshwater streams like these before heading to the sea, where they live for 1 or 2 years. Then they return to the same freshwater spot to lay eggs of their own. Each summer, these biologists also return to count the number of coho salmon and steelhead trout. The data paints a picture of the health of the endangered species and the entire ecosystem. It gets used by other local organizations like the Sonoma County Water Agency and national organizations like Fish and Wildlife to help justify restoration projects. The biologists in their puffy suits may look silly, but their methods are calculated, even the steelhead shuffle. The move looks just as quirky as the name sounds. Mariska describes why Elizabeth moves her feet to the right, to the left, and to the right and left again.
When the water's really shallow, you can't really see the fish in there, so we're just kind of trying to chase them up, and you kind of shuffle your feet to get the fish to move up to a place that you can count them.
And then she crouches down on all fours, lowers her face and body in the water, and starts to pull herself up the stream. Part swimming, part floating, part crawling when the stream gets too shallow. She peers around the roots of redwood trees and the pools that form underneath them with her flashlight, checking to see if any fish are hiding in there. She herds any fish she spots in front of her so she doesn't count the same one twice.
We snorkel in as little as like a couple inches of water sometimes. Like, we really can drag ourselves through it to get numbers and get eyes on the fish.
They have to be quick and stealthy and sly.
From above, it just looks like this, you know, tiny little puddle in a way. You know, the creeks are so small right now. But then when you get, you know, when you're looking underwater, it's like, wow, there is a whole nother world under here. You know, you can see insects, you can see different fish.
On shore, we stay quiet and still. We crane our necks and follow Elizabeth as she rounds the bend of the pool. She emerges, dripping wet, looking like a creature from the Black Lagoon. Then she peels off her mask.
No fish. No fish. Okay.
No fish here, echoes Mariska. She types a zero into her tiny orange field computer. And we trek on to the next section. We'll visit about 25 different pools today in the creek. This summer, they'll survey nearly 100 different streams that make up the Russian River. Mariska's been collecting data this way almost 15 years. But since she grew up along a stream in Marin County, she's actually been counting salmon for much longer. When she was a kid, her family would celebrate the return of salmon each fall. The rivers would be practically overflowing with fish.
You know, every winter, like, one of the things we would always do together is look for the fish. You know, we'd have the big first rain and you know, we had certain little walks that we'd do along the creeks to go see the fish.
Mariska helped start the Russian River snorkel survey back in 2004. She'd trek up and down streams and not see a single fish. A year later, coho salmon moved from a threatened species to an endangered one. Biologists counted fewer than 10 fish returning to the Russian River to spawn that year. A history of population growth and development along the river is partly to blame, with people logging trees, digging wells, mining gravel, watering grapevines, building dams. That's all really hard on salmon.
For them to complete their life cycle, every piece of the puzzle has to be in good enough shape for them to do that.
So government agencies and nonprofit conservation groups work to save the species, starting a fish hatchery to grow and release more salmon, building a fish ladder to help salmon get over dams, convincing landowners to build rainwater storage systems, and pulling fallen trees into the river to create better salmon habitat.
Many years ago, there was, you know, a lot of effort to, like, clear the streams out of all the wood and, you know, like, clear the channels. And now there's, like, a ton of work to put all this wood back in because it's so important for helping these fish populations recover.
Over time, the numbers from the snorkel surveys can tell biologists where to focus their efforts.
Yeah, I'm kind of surprised I haven't fallen in. Yeah, okay. Don't jinx it.
For us, the restored salmon habitat creates a slippery obstacle course as we trek over and under down trees to snorkel more pools further up the river. Some have no fish, like the first pool. Others are more promising.
It's usually a good sign.
You can tell it's good news from the bank when you hear a little peep come out of the snorkel. We start to hear numbers like 2 and 5 fish and 10 fish being yelled back.
In that pool, there were 2 coho yoi, and they were hanging out like right in the middle here in this deep spot, both of them.
Yoi means young of the year, the babies born in 2018. Even though I don't have a mask on, I begin to see some salmon too.
It's like right in the deepest spot, like along that dark leaf edge.
Oh yeah, there.
The fish are tiny, no bigger than the length of my pointer finger. Not what you'd expect to see when you picture a salmon. These are just juveniles, born here when their parents defeated all odds and laid their eggs here last fall. Mariska says this means the restoration efforts are working. Then she lowers her body and face into maybe 2 inches of water to snorkel. Even with just a trickle of water, these salmon are extremely resilient. It's just enough for them to survive. In Willow Creek, for Cross Currents, I'm Angela Johnston.
Angela visited Willow Creek last year. Go to KALW.org to find more information about how to keep up with the Russian River Salmon Project. And make sure you're subscribed to the Cross Currents newsletter to get all our stories and interviews right in your inbox each week. This music is by Suzanne Chani, based in Bolinas. Envelope SF will play her album Quadraphonic in their fully sound immersive studio tomorrow night.
Today's Cross Currents team includes Janae Darden, Audrey Dilling, Sophie Codner, Lisa Morehouse, Adriana Morga, True Quinn, Marissa Ortega-Welch, Jocelyn Tabankai, and Eli Wordshafter. Our engineers are James Rollins, Tariq Foda, and Gabe Graben. Content manager is Shireen Adil. Deputy News Director is Angela Johnston. News Director is Ben Trefney. Our opening theme music is by the John Santos Quintet. For Cross Currents, I'm Hannah Baba.